The next matter on the calendar is the case of the State of Minnesota versus Jamar Charles Young. Counsel, when you approach the podium, please identify yourselves for us. Appellant, when you're ready, you may proceed.
Good morning. My name is Craig Cascarano. I represent the appellant, Jamar Charles Young. There are two issues that we have raised in our brief. One is regarding the probable cause of the search warrant. The second, and maybe I hesitate to say this, but perhaps the more important issue is the knock and announce issue. So law enforcement got a search warrant to search this residence, and as discovery came along, it came to pass that the law enforcement misrepresented three what I believe to be crucial factors in the warrant. Now, I know the county attorney in their brief said that didn't misrepresent, it was just kind of unintentional, but I would direct the court's attention to Judge Anderson's representations, which she indicated that the parties actually agreed there were misrepresentations by the law enforcement.
And the question is whether or not they were material. They're therefore necessitating a Franks hearing.
Exactly. And we disagree respectfully with Judge Anderson on her finding. I would like to add one additional factor that is part of the record that I didn't bring up in my brief, but the second mailing, which is a prescription receipt that actually is the same address as the address that the search warrant was executed, but was a different name, was Jamar Young reversed. There is a date of birth on that, and that is the date of birth, which is completely different than the date of birth of the defendant. So I'm not sure that's relevant. It just wasn't in the brief, but I think that that's important. It is part of the record.
But in the course of determining materiality, didn't the court properly consider whether or not if you take away from the search warrant affidavit and application, the misrepresentations, whether there's sufficient evidence beyond that that supports probable cause?
There's no question the judge followed the appropriate one, two, three steps in whether or not to get to the Franks hearing. I am not disputing that she didn't do that. I'm just disputing her conclusion. And her conclusions are actually identified in itemized on page 6, paragraph 11 of her order, and she goes through the five factors that if you delete the misrepresentations and the omission that the law enforcement didn't indicate to the court that the trash receptacle was a shared receptacle, the first two, of course, is a concerned citizen made a report. The concerned citizen had seen narcotics in the home, and then the concerned citizen identified Mr. Young as the person inside the home. The other three actually dovetail the omissions in and of itself. So although she does indicate that, actually it's not page 6, Your Honors, I'm sure, I think it's page, hold on a second. It's page 5, paragraph 4, paragraph 6. Anyway, she identifies the five factors. First two I've indicated. The next three dovetail the actual misrepresentations by law enforcement. So it's our position that there is not probable cause based upon the search warrant. In the final analysis, it seems to me that if this is a highly unusual case, this court, we've all been around the block. Very rare is it that the county attorney is going to concede that law enforcement lied in the affidavit. And I understand.
Well, lying suggests intention. I'm not sure that the state went that far, but agreed that they were misrepresentations.
What I was going to say is I understand lie is a very strong word. It is very difficult to try to look at these misrepresentations and come up with some sort of rationale that they were unintentional. How in the world can you put in there that The one mailing is to Jamar Young at that particular address, but the address is completely different.
But you can't
make that mistake.
Don't you kind of get ahead of the argument by arguing that these misrepresentations were intentional? That's a fact finding that is made at a Franks hearing, and it certainly isn't a fact finding that this court is going to make.
I'm not suggesting this court make that finding. I'm suggesting that Judge Anderson, in her review of probable cause, did the appropriate 1, 2, 3 step, but it seems to me that there should have been some sort of hearing to determine whether or not it was intentional. And if it was, why in the world did they make it?
A Franks hearing.
Exactly.
But you don't get a Franks hearing unless the misrepresentations are material.
I understand that.
And I just
disagree with the court's finding that they if you delete that from the search warrant, that there is still probable cause. I don't think she's right, but...
Can I follow up with a question?
Of course.
When you were pointing out paragraph 6, and I thought you referenced 3, 4, and 5 in that paragraph, she identifies dovetails as the phrase. And I'm trying to understand what you mean by that, because 3, whether it has his name, regardless of the address, that's part of what she's referring to. And then the prescription bottle has a Young name, not the same Young, but I understand that. And then the presence of cocaine, which I understand the point about the shared dumpster, but it still happens to be the same receptacle. So my question is, what do you mean by dovetail? How does that take away from what she's identifying in 3, 4, and 5, assuming the misrepresentation?
If there's misrepresentations, the law is very clear that those misrepresentations are deleted from the search warrant, literally redacted.
But didn't she do that? In other words, you take away the address, you still have his name.
You still have his name. There's no question about that, but it's still all part of the same thing. If you redact that sentence in those sentences in the probable cause portion of the affidavit, then those things aren't even in existence. You don't even come to the conclusion that her name is or his name is there.
But the judge did that. You're agreeing the judge did that. You're just disagreeing that 3, 4, and 5
exactly,
together with 1 and 2 support probable cause.
That's exactly. And listen, I get the fact that at least I believe that reasonable minds can differ. I understand the judge made the determination it was probable cause. I candidly oftentimes have told this court that sometimes in these arguments I'm standing at the bottom of Mount Everest looking up, and maybe that's my argument here, and I understand that. And as I started this, I also candidly and frankly indicated to the court that as I've represented Mr. Young and went through this, that at least I believe that the bigger issue here is the knock and announce issue, which the court determined was not supported by any reasonable suspicion. In fact, she said it didn't even come close, and law enforcement still went forward and executed the warrant. So there's all sorts of case law in which I don't need to go through the what the balancing test is. Obviously, if you're going to have a knock and announce warrant, it has to be supported by reasonable suspicion. The court made a determination here that it wasn't. In fact, it wasn't even close. They've made reference to a 2003 case, a 2016 case, and some conclusory statement that he was a member of a vice lord gang, all of which she indicated was not even close to reasonable suspicion. Nevertheless, law enforcement executed the warrant on a knock and announced basis. I've cited to the court Garza, Martinez, of course, the benchmark case of Wasson. And as I've tried to put this together for the argument, the question is whether or not, I believe the question is whether or not this type of police misconduct is the kind of conduct that we should penalize, so to speak, or have a consequence of suppression of the evidence.
Well, you can hardly call it police misconduct when they got the warrant for the no-knock.
Well, they got and that's exactly what
goes Garza's back to the warrant.
Well, you go back. So the words that these cases deal with is whether there's a good faith exception, right? I mean, that's really what we're talking about here. They got a warrant, no question about it. The judge said they should have not got a knock and an unannounced knock warrant, right? That's what it's all about. They did it anyways. So the question is this the kind of case where there's a good faith exception? And the answer to that is no. This is not a good faith exception. The county attorney, in their brief, cited to you the Lindquist case, right? The Lindquist case is not dispositive because the Lindquist case dealt with the DWI where they didn't get a warrant for a blood test, and it specifically states that the law enforcement can rely upon, quote, binding appellate precedent, right? We don't have any binding appellate precedent here. This is a constitutional violation of unreasonable search and seizures.
So how many judges worked on this case? Three?
Well, two, actually. Well, no, just one. I mean, Judge Anderson did it. She's the one that initially did it. I made a motion in front of Judge Redding to reopen the case because when I reread the case law, and I don't know how you pronounce it, Botello, there is a, it appears as though there's a requirement that the state present evidence that law enforcement reappraised the situation prior to the execution of the warrant to see whether or not a knock and announce was necessary. Case law is pretty clear. I didn't need to do that. It's a state's burden to do that. That's what Garza says, that's what Lindquist says, and that's what Martinez says. But I did it anyways because I was confident that if the court reopened and it allowed us to take testimony that law enforcement did not reappraise it, or if they did, there's still no reason in the world to do a knock and announce. That motion was denied by Judge Redding. So I tried to make the record clear. I didn't have to do that. If you read the case law, it's the state's obligation to present evidence that law enforcement reappraised the situation. And but we already got to that point. So it's the state's burden to put it. They didn't, the record's clear that there's no information with regard to reappraisal, and I think that cuts greatly against the state at this stage of the game.
Well, you know, Garza is a case that really criticized the use of boilerplate.
Yep.
And so this case isn't a case in which the affidavit could be construed. I mean, you can't really accurately characterize it as boilerplate.
It's not boilerplate.
So the question is it sufficient? I mean, Garza tells us boilerplate isn't sufficient.
Exactly.
But it doesn't tell us that what's in this affidavit isn't sufficient.
It doesn't.
So we have to really look at the language here.
And the judge has already done that. And not only did she find there wasn't reasonable suspicion, I think you can read in that it wasn't even close to reasonable suspicion. She indicates that the statements that support the knock and announce do not even support the low bar. So we aren't even close to reasonable suspicion.
On that point, Mr. Coscarano, is not our obligation to review the issuing magistrate to whether there's substantial basis that probable cause exists. I understand the point you're making. This is unique, and the judge made specific findings at the omnibus at suppression hearing. But do we not go past her? And that's the point that Stauber's referring to. There was, in my recollection, three different judges. There was a different judge issued the search warrant. Is it not that judge's search warrant that we evaluate? In other words, can we not simply, under that legal obligation, disagree with the trial court's finding?
Well, without a doubt, you can disagree with the trial court's finding. I would hope you not do that, obviously. And I think the court can review that to determine whether or not the trial court made an abuse of discretion. I guess I interpreted Justice Stauber's question of how many judges looked at the particular search warrant. Obviously, it was the one that signed it. Judge Anderson dealt with the hearing, but Judge Redding ultimately got the case for sentencing and things like that just because Judge Anderson was sent to a different portion of the family court or something like that. Judge Redding really didn't have any input except the denial of the motion to reopen for evidence about how the search warrant was executed. Again, the idea being, did they reappraise the situation? And I do want to emphasize that it wasn't my responsibility to do that. The state has, the case law is very clear that that's their responsibility to show, because if there's no reappraisal and there is no reasonable suspicion to support a no-knock, then it's a constitutional violation that requires suppression. That's what Garza says. That's what Lindquist says. In fact, Lindquist is very is very instructive, because it says that in that they are not saying that there's a good faith exception when law enforcement executes a facially deficient warrant. And I'm not, probable cause on the warrant itself isn't dispositive. It's probable, it's reasonable suspicion to do the night. So in the bottom line, as I've gone through this thing, is do we not impose any consequences upon law enforcement when they do this? This is, you can couple in the lack of reasonable suspicion with the misrepresentations in the first place, and the whole search warrant is, to be discreet, weird at best, right? Everybody talks about good faith. My position as a defense attorney is this is a bad faith warrant. There's no way in the world that anybody can logically conclude that those statements to support probable cause were put there by mistake. That's not the case. And to put into a search warrant a 2003 case or a 2016 warrant where they found a bullet and then some conclusionary thing that he's a vice lord and use that to support reasonable suspicion to break into the house without knocking, is the whole warrant, I think, in a whole, you can view to find out whether or not this is the kind of search where the court found no reasonable suspicion and that there should be consequences, the consequences of which should be suppression of all the evidence. And I strongly believe that that's what should happen here. Thank you.
You'll have rebuttal if you wish.
Thank you.
Respondent.
May it please the court. Counsel, Your Honors, my name is Brittany Lawan, and I'm an assistant Hennepin County attorney appearing on behalf of the state. The state submits, as we argued in our brief, that the district court properly denied the motion for a Franks hearing because here the question was whether or not this was material. And the district court did the proper analysis in concluding that the misrepresentations were not material to the finding of probable cause. And just to be frank and clear, the state does not in any way concede that these were intentional or reckless. The state agrees that there were misrepresentations and that there was an omission with regard to the duplex being shared, so the trash might have been from two units. However, the state at no point conceded that this was intentional or that there was bad conduct at play. And that's jumping ahead in the analysis because the question is whether or not the misrepresentations are material. If they're not material, you don't even get to that finding. Additionally, with regard to the district court's order on page 4, which I believe I've cited on page 9 of my brief, which outlines the 5 reasons why, if the misrepresentations were left out of the probable cause determination, there still is probable cause, the district court did the analysis correct here. If you take out the address that was incorrect, if you take out the name Ramaj Young, which is Jamar Young backwards, but if you take out that name, and then if you add in the fact that this was a shared unit, there still is enough here for probable cause, which is why the district court correctly denied the Franks hearing motion. Additionally, with regard to the suppression motion and the conclusion that the no-knock provision was improper here, this court actually does an independent determination of whether or not the evidence should have been suppressed. So under State v. Grunig, the state is actually allowed to argue at this stage that the district court should be affirmed for any reasons, as long as it doesn't expand the relief. Here, this court could conclude that the no-knock provision was enough in this case. But even if this...
Why would we conclude that?
You could hear because I think it's a little bit more particularized. Like Your Honor mentioned, it's not similar to Garza, where it was the boilerplate language that's at issue in Richards versus Wisconsin, and that basically just says this is a drug case, so therefore we get to go in. It's not that. It's not a lot. I'm not going to try to argue that this is completely the perfect amount of information. It would be a little bit more relevant if there was more there, but this is close. And in a close case like this, there is deference granted to the magistrate.
Well, what if we don't decide it with an independent review that the facts justified the no-knock? What then? Doesn't the law call for suppression?
Your Honor, even if you don't conclude that the no-knock was justified, suppression is not required.
What's your strongest case to support that proposition?
Botello actually talks about that, and that's going to be at 638 Northwest 2nd, 778.
But in Botello, this court, and the opinion being written by now Justice Barry Anderson, reversed.
That's correct, Your Honor, but looking at the language in Botello, there's a discussion about when an officer complied with established procedure and obtained judicial pre-approval for an unannounced entry, this, quote, weighs against excluding the evidence seized. And so here, the judge approved it, the officer relied on that, went out and executed the search warrant, and was acting in good faith in that instance. Also, the language in Lindquist, I agree, this Lindquist goes to a blood draw on a DWI case. It's not directly on point, but there's also language in Lindquist talking specifically about, as I outline, I think on page 21 of my brief.
Yeah, but you know, you don't spend too much time on that argument, because there were numerous dissenters in Lindquist, and I just, you know. Go ahead.
That's fair, Your Honor. I just would point out, though, that the court recognizes that they've refused to suppress evidence in circumstances in which the police have acted in good faith reliance on a judicial determination or where suppression would not deter misconduct. Here, this is that type of case. The officers went to the judge, they obtained a warrant, and then they executed that warrant. Now, in hindsight, and reviewing it by a different judge, which would be Judge Anderson in this case, it's a determination that there should not have been a no-knock.
Is it safe to say, Ms. Lawan, there's no case where a judge has found, or an appellate court, a lack of evidence for a no-knock in which it was not suppressed? And even Botello, the language you're referring to, and in terms of the instruction that case gives us, or even law enforcement or district court judges, at the end, Justice Anderson, consequently, the evidence found in appellant's residence must be suppressed. So was not that an error of law in this case for the trial judge to make the findings there was no basis, make reference to this case and say it ought not to be suppressed? Was that not an error of law? She made the findings already that there wasn't a basis. Should that not have been an automatic, therefore it must be suppressed? There's no law, in other words, that supported her decision, including Botello.
Your Honor, I don't think that there's any law that says that it's absolutely mandatory. I think that the language in the cases says that it can weigh against suppressing it if they're relying on it. I think that Botello is also distinguishable here because that has no particularized findings. That's also more of a boilerplate language. So I think that although I'm trying to use the language that helps me in Botello, the end result in Botello, you also have to look at the underlying facts. The case there, I believe it was pretty boilerplate with regard to a showing of dangerousness and talking about customers and how the customers that were there were going to be possibly dangerous, but they didn't do the follow-up to find out whether or not who they were when they observed the people. Here, they're talking about the individual who actually lived in the residence, so that's more particularized. So I don't think that there's necessarily a case that says that it's automatically reversible. I think, if anything, there's wiggle room, especially after Lindquist and especially with you look at the language in Botello, I believe it's quoting Warsame, which I probably am butchering the name on that, but I believe.
Point being, there is no case, though, that did not suppress.
I don't believe so. I can scour and look, and I actually will look to make sure there isn't an unpublished one that I missed in the interim to check. But I don't think that it's an error of law here. I think that looking at the circumstances, it is true that the showing is not high and it wasn't met here. But this isn't an instance where the district court made an erroneous conclusion of law. If the court has no further questions, I would rest on my brief and ask that this court appeal the district court. Thank you.
Appeal.
pregnancy brain, I'm sorry. Affirm the district court.
Don't add to our workload, please.
Affirm the district court's order. Thank you.
Any rebuttal?
Maybe. Every time I get up on rebuttal, it always reminds me of a saying that someone told me a long time ago when I started out. Those lawyers says, never say anything that doesn't add knowledge to silence, but I've never followed that, unfortunately.
Well, most of us don't.
Okay, then I feel better about that. The fact that it's boilerplate is irrelevant. I think you put it better than I could ever, which is, if there's a finding that there's no support for the unannounced entry, what's the appropriate remedy? The judge already made the determination that it was not supported by reasonable suspicion. I understand that the court can review that. I'm not suggesting that you can't. But if you come to the same conclusion, then the $64,000 question in this case is, what is the consequence? What is the remedy? And there isn't a case that I have found, at least, that doesn't say it shouldn't be suppressed. The reason I brought up this reappraisal issue is that language is used in Botello to somehow say, well, if they go out and then they realize, even though they've got a no-knock warrant and they realize that it shouldn't be executed that way, then they shouldn't execute it that way. That's not the case here whatsoever. They did go in, they executed the no-knock warrant.
Well, what would have caused them to reappraise the situation and decide that a no-knock wasn't necessary?
I don't know what those factors are, and they've never been laid out by any court that here or the Supreme Court that I have found, but the language is used. Maybe you look and see, well, there isn't, I looked through the window and there isn't any danger for us, it doesn't appear to be any guns, and so therefore we, I don't know what it is. And I actually struggled long and hard as to try to figure out what that even meant. But be that as it may, the fact that one of the other cases was, or some of the other cases are boilerplate language is really irrelevant. I think this entire issue boils down to the no-knock issue is, what is the approach? First of all, if this court agrees with the trial court that it wasn't reasonable suspicion, and you can certainly, that's one determination that has to be made. If you agree with Judge Anderson, then the focal issue is, what is the consequence? What is the remedy? And there isn't any court who says that there is a good faith, just because law enforcement is relied upon the judge who signed the warrant, that therefore it's good faith and it is not suppressed. That's not what the law is.
Counsel, in Wasson, the Supreme Court specifically said that it was not deciding whether or not to adopt a good faith exception in the knock and announce rule. So we know that the Supreme Court has never said since Wasson, in which it did not say, that there is a good faith exception.
Yep.
Here's the language that I'm curious about in Wasson. The court talked about the process that it had described in Lien, L-I-E-N.
Yep.
And it said that in Wasson, the police officers followed that process. They went to a magistrate. They got a warrant. They got permission to conduct a no-knock search. And then the Supreme Court said the officers' compliance with our direction weighs against excluding the evidence seized. How do we not apply that language to this case?
I don't think the next sentence is it weighs against us excluding the evidence, so therefore we now exclude the evidence. It would be great if they continued the sentence on them, but they didn't, and there isn't any case that says that. The state cited Lindquist, which you have referenced, right? That it was very clear. It says the majority opinion simply said, we do not decide here whether applying the exclusionary rule to evidence obtained in other ways, such as a facially deficient search warrant.
You don't have to argue to me about the good faith exception.
We don't have.
I don't think that it's been applied by the Supreme Court in the search warrant area, and I won't be the judge first applying it.
I think that's the rub of the green
of
the whole argument.
But my concern here is that in Wasson, the court upheld the search and the Supreme Court, and it said that officers' compliance weighs against excluding the evidence. So I'm asking you, why in this case is suppression the right result?
I believe the answer to that, in a very short, curt answer, is that's the law. That's the law on Lindquist. If you don't suppress the evidence in this case, which, again, I believe the search warrant in its entirety should be viewed by this court, I respectfully disagree that these were unintentional misrepresentations, but forget that. They were misrepresentations. The connotation of misrepresentation is, I don't know how you can misrepresent something unintentionally. It just doesn't make any sense, right? So if you look at the entire in its entirety.
But the law.
I understand that. But nevertheless, if you look at the search warrant in its entirety and the fact that the trial court said it wasn't even close to reasonable suspicion, that this is the case. This is exactly the kind of case where suppression is mandated by the case law, certainly by Lindquist and Garza, because if you don't, then essentially in this case, this court has determined that there is somehow a good faith exception because law enforcement executed the warrant based upon what they believed was a reasonable suspicion that they could do an unknown.
All right, and your time is up.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. The matter has been well argued, and it is taken under advisement.